I've always wanted a ham radio set. And now that I've got one, I'm going to listen in on distress signals and notify the authorities and prevent disasters and noble things like that. Calling CQ, calling CQ. Come in, please.
Hey, this is Anya.
And this is Peter.
And we're from Rock and Roll High School every first and third Wednesday at 8 p.m.
And you're listening to WGXC, Acre, Hudson, Catskill, 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, baby. Wow.
Hi, this is Michael Wilde inviting you to Mostly Singles. And if you like what you're hearing, you'll love this show. Rarefied music, premieres, and guests. It's different every time. And a podcast, too. Go to WGXC.org. Mostly Singles, every fourth Tuesday at 8 to 10 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Investing in local community spaces and media is more important than ever right now. Wave Farms WGXC Radio for Open Ears is committed to providing a platform for independent perspectives and creative expression in New York's Upper Hudson Valley. And in 2026, we're working to ground our WGXC Catskill studio as a nexus point for our community to create, learn, and come together. And we need your help. Our goal is to raise $10,000 to make this a reality. Go to WGXC.org/donate now to make your contribution. We thank you for your support.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Mike Coyne of Glenmark, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, December 12th. Local early morning temperatures range from 10 degrees in Red Hook to 20 in Skodak. Regional average soil temperature is 35 degrees. Snow totals are in from yesterday. North Blenheim saw an inch. Ravenna got also an inch. Saugerties, 1.1 inches. Greenville Center got 1.5. Westerlo also 1.5. And Tannersville winds with 3.5 inches. Today is looking dry and clear with a high of 33 at 3 p.m. Overnight temperatures will linger at 18 degrees once they bottom out. We get some light snowfall Saturday morning and a high of 39 at 3 p.m. Then, after dark, we get to see Snow 2 Electric Boogaloo. A quarter inch may fall by midnight, then another half inch by morning. Sunday, the snow comes to an end by noon, and we see a high of 27 at 2 p.m. Monday, a tiny chance for snow will be around, and we see a high of 28. Sunset today will be at 4:11 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:11 a.m. Looking way up, we see the Geminid meteor shower is happening this weekend. The best viewing times will be between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. X-class flare chances are at 10%. Plasma winds will be average at 423 kilometers per second with a thin density of 4 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently being impacted on all frequencies with a level 4 noise floor. There are low chances of aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 123. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate. And it is definitely getting cold outside there, folks. And one sure way to get a warm and fuzzy feeling is to head on over to WGXC.org and donate to your favorite community radio station. We love you guys so much.
Public news. News Service Friday, December 12th, 2025 afternoon update. I'm Edwin J. Vieira. Groups that work in Florida for environmental justice are voicing concerns about the Environmental Protection Agency putting off a big decision. Farah Siddiqui reports.
The agency's 2024 methane rule would require major reductions in methane emissions and other air pollution from oil and gas industry. The move to delay implementing it for another 18 months has drawn strong criticism from groups, including We Act for Environmental Justice, which says local communities bear the health and economic burdens of this pollution. Yosef Robele with We Act says the delay directly puts public health protections at risk.
This delay is unfortunately more likely than not going to result in unnecessary deaths or a continuation of high rates of ER visits, public health burdens being placed on communities near it.
The EPA's own analysis shows the methane rule could prevent 1,500 premature deaths and 100,000 asthma attacks each year. Environmental groups say delaying enforcement undermines protections for communities living closest to industrial emissions.
West Virginia is among a group of states leading criminal justice reform with the help of the Just Trust, a national philanthropy group. Nadia Romlagan has more.
Anna Zamora, the Just Trust founder and CEO, says work is also being done to improve conditions for people in prisons. She notes the current lack of prison guards impacts incarcerated people's ability to eat meals, seek medical or dental care, or perform duties.
We have a shortage of prison guards, and it's a real problem. So improving the middle of the funnel, as we say, is a critical part of the work of justice reform.
Nationwide, there are more than 31,000 vacant guard positions each year. Census data show state prisons lost 12% of their full-time workforce between 2013 and 2023, with nearly all of the decline occurring during the pandemic years. At the same time, West Virginia has struggled to address jail overcrowding.
Groups promoting offshore wind power are hopeful that a big win in court will convince the federal government to consider permitting new projects. Suzanne Potter has the story.
This week, a federal judge struck down President Donald Trump's day one executive order, which halted all offshore wind approvals, and argued that the Biden administration unfairly favored renewable energy over oil and gas. Benjamin Collings is offshore wind advisor for the group Elected Officials to Protect America.
Individual projects still going to have to continue the route it's on. For example, projects like in the Port of Humboldt, they can continue without being permanently stopped, which the White House was trying to do.
California has five offshore wind projects in development, two off of Humboldt Bay and three off the coast of Morro Bay.
Democratic Texas Representative Al Green introduced articles of impeachment against Trump for abuses of power, inciting violence, and death threats against lawmakers and federal judges. Green's first impeachment resolution against Trump in June accused the administration of bypassing Congress to possibly declare war on Iran after a series of airstrikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. The latest articles of impeachment were rejected by a bipartisan majority. This is Public News Service. Child care workers at the University of Michigan say low and stagnant wages are pushing them out of the jobs their families depend on. As Crystal Blair reports, their union is fighting back.
The labor union University Staff United has handed out flyers to parents this week at all three U of M child care centers, urging support as contract negotiations continue. The union says many early childhood educators earn wages so low they're working multiple jobs just to get by. USU Vice President Therese Theophilus says the financial strain is pushing some staff to take desperate measures.
And we're there almost 10 hours. And then some of the teachers go home and some of them have to actually go to soup kitchens to eat. And last week, another teacher had to move from our apartment because it went up $300.
The University of Michigan says it has been negotiating in good faith and notes that its child care centers operate within broader university budget constraints. U of M points to its recent order of a one-time payment and adjustments to workload policies, saying those proposals reflect meaningful progress, while larger compensation decisions must go through the school's regents and central administration.
New research says birth rates for gray whales are still low, likely due to climate change affecting their food sources. However, melting sea ice has created new feeding opportunities, and as Isabel Charlet reports, scientists are hopeful the whales can adapt, allowing populations to rebound.
Gray whales are known to have what are known as unusual mortality events, when many whales die at once, followed by an uptick in their populations. But researcher Sue Moore at the University of Washington says the whales don't seem to be recovering from their latest mortality event that started in 2019.
Why we're concerned now is we are having an unusual mortality event, because after a brief looking recovery, bang, the numbers of stranded whales went up, the estimate went down. Maybe this UME is not over. This is something different.
Moore adds that with the loss of sea ice in Alaska, more warm water is now passing through the Bering Strait, bringing with it nutrients and new prey for the whales, who feed achieved by filtering tiny shrimp and other animals from the ocean floor. She says the whales are known to be highly adaptable feeders, and it is possible this trait will help them survive a rapidly changing climate.
A Boston judge ruled the Trump administration's nearly year-long ban on permitting for wind farms was illegal. This allows New York and other states to develop clean energy projects proponents say will benefit energy independence. Marguerite Wells with the Alliance for Clean Energy New York says wind energy can do a lot to help the state.
Wind energy is often the most powerful at night and in the winter when solar is the weakest. So solar and wind actually work together to provide a balanced renewable energy portfolio to the grid. Then there's the economic benefits. There's a lot of jobs in developing, building, and operating these projects, and they also generate a lot of tax revenues for the host communities.
This comes as New York's Power Authority approved a plan to double its goal for solar, wind, and energy storage projects. The hope is that new investments will kickstart clean power in the state as private markets continue to rely on fossil fuels. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Public News Service, member and listener supported. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hey, this is Lucy, the host of the WGXC First Friday Afternoon Show. As you may have noticed, today is not the first Friday, and it's also 3 o'clock. I have a special episode for you today. I'm still live in the Catskill studio at 393 Main Street, as usual. So come on down and give me a wave if you're around. But I have a special interview, as I said, with Natasha Chuk, who wrote a very interesting book about something near and dear to my heart, photography. It's called Photo Obscura, and I just had to create a special spot for Natasha to come in and talk to us about that book. So thank you so much, Natasha, for being here, and welcome to the Catskill Studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to talk about your book, obviously, Photo Obscura, that is, again. But first, a couple of background things. You have a PhD in philosophy, art, and critical thought, which is very interesting, very specific and very interesting. You're a media theorist and writer who focuses on the relationships between art, philosophy, and technology. You also wrote another book called Vanishing Points, Articulation of Death, Fragmentation, and the Unexperienced Experience of Creating Objects, of Created Objects. You've been the recipient of grants, residencies for your writing, and you teach media theory at the School of Visual Arts and Parsons in New York City. Mm-hmm. So basically, you know what you're talking about.
I hope so.
Do any of us, though?
No, not really.
So as a photographer myself, I was incredibly interested in your book when Galen, who's the executive director of Wave Farm, when she told me about it and when I first picked it up. So usually I discuss with people their backgrounds and things like that, but I really want to jump in to the book just because I feel like we have so much to talk about.
Yeah.
But first, for our listeners who aren't experienced in the history of photography, there's a lot to talk about there because your book goes into post-photography theories, you know, with the onset of obviously smartphones and the access to photography that everybody has. There's kind of a lot leading up to that in the history of photography. And I wanted to discuss that with you for our listeners first, and then we'll get to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also interested to hear what your point of view is on that. We were kind of discussing that before we went on the air and we had to stop ourselves.
Yeah.
There's so much. Yeah. Get ahead of ourselves. But from my point of view, with the history of photography, it's always been kind of viewed as an accessible art form or almost too easy.
Sure.
So this kind of chip on its shoulder as an art form, as a capital A art form, it just keeps getting worse.
Sure.
I feel like for people who make their art using photography and then people outside of it looking at photography, there's always kind of been this struggle of where does photography fit in as an art form?
Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of, can you walk our listeners through, how we got to here to this post? I know that a synopsis,
right? Really quickly.
Yeah, really quickly. Well, we have an hour.
Yeah.
You know, how photography has been perceived up until this point.
Mm.
So
that's
I'm trying to narrow it down for
right.
you.
Well, I think I like what you're asking, because in some ways it's important to think about this crisis of photography and art, capital A art. And initially it was believed that because it's easy, especially after the Brownie camera was introduced, which was in 1900 and kind of set the stage for this single button push, mm-hmm. right? Like, take a photo, you don't have to know anything, you don't need any skills whatsoever, you don't even have to know how to load the camera,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to process it yourself. Kodak, like, cornered the market, created a market for this, and really facilitated vernacular photography, what we know is like just the snapshot,
the
right?
Point and shoot, yeah.
Point and shoot, absolutely. And so that set the tone for something which wasn't art necessarily, but it definitely was documentation. So I feel like there's a capital A art problem,
mm-hmm.
but there's also a capital T truth problem,
yep.
right? So photography from the beginning was a way for us to forego having to draw something, mm-hmm. right? Like, oh, I don't know how to draw, so this is going to be so much easier for mm-hmm. me, right? And certainly that helped kind of propel the discovery of how to create this mechanism, the apparatus and everything that followed that would allow us to do that, right? Mm-hmm. To recreate the world around us. And without the subjectivity of my hand, how good am I as an illustrator or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, all of a sudden we started to have these questions about, well, now the artist is the person who can draw, right? Suddenly mm-hmm. that's the person who has like the skills to do something.
Like the artisan aspect of
artisan
art.
Artisan aspect yeah. of art, mm-hmm. for sure. But I think also these kind of scientific elements of photography, and so much of it was born out of scientific experimentation,
yep.
Medical imaging, things like this. So many people were involved, not necessarily artists, not necessarily people who were interested in using it creatively.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, from the beginning, it wasn't considered an art mm-hmm. form. And then many people had a hard time accepting it.
But it also wasn't seen as a folk art either.
No, no,
or,
not at all.
Or a technical thing even per se. So I feel like that mm. kind of adds to this chip on the shoulder kind of where does it fit in? It's difficult to fit in a box. I mean, you and I who know photography, we know that it's highly technical.
Sure.
You know, but if somebody else is, you know, just walking down the street and they see somebody taking a picture, you know, they're not necessarily thinking about all of the technical aspects. They're just seeing the button.
Sure. I think that idea of like the abstraction of the technology is part of why we think like, oh, you don't have to know anything to
yeah.
take a photograph, right?
Or even today when it's like somebody wants you to take their picture, they're like, it doesn't have to be fancy. You're like, right. Well, there's
actually,
still
it does,
some right? involved.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, so photography is always, like I said, kind of, it had a difficult time, I feel like, in and of itself. A photographer's kind of felt that. Mm-hmm. Other people from the outside looking in felt that it doesn't necessarily fit in a specific box.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as you were discussing, as the technology became more and more and more accessible, all the way through to today, where everybody has a camera in their pocket,
yeah.
you know, it just continued to be more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, what does that mean? Where does that not necessarily where does it end, but it just keeps getting harder to slot it in somewhere cleanly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the sort of short answer for me is it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's actually informed the way that we see the world. I think we see the world photographically. We
mm-hmm.
think photographically.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not even training ourselves to do that necessarily. This is like most people, right? Because it's like inherent in a lot of the tools that we use, not just maybe the, you know, program on your phone or whatever, but also in the way everything's framed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like our cameras, but also our computers, our TVs, everything. So I think there is this sort of like photography is nowhere and everywhere,
yeah.
sort of like it has this like omniscience or something,
yeah.
omnipresence. I think that's where I'm going with some of the things that I'm looking at in this book, and this idea of post-photography being this kind of umbrella term that encompasses all those things,
mm-hmm.
all the problems, but also all the things that photography has changed. So while some people sort of argue that photography is dead or it's become something else and we don't like it,
mm-hmm.
right? Not this, right?
Yep.
This isn't what we wanted. This isn't real photography.
Yes.
You know, that goes back to like, well, now we want the thing that we were trying to deny wasn't
yes.
an art form. That suddenly looks like an art form to us. So
I think that's
interesting.
Yeah, that's incredibly interesting to me because as the technologies change, you know, the newest one that's on the horizon, people reject.
Oh, for sure.
But then they look back. I mean, it's like, okay, as a working photographer today, I have my fine art practice with photo. Mm-hmm. And then I also have, you know, the commercial for money side.
Sure.
And the thing that I think is very interesting are the trends. Mm-hmm. So right now there is a trend, which I feel too old for, where it's, you know, grainy, it's point and shoot looking, there's green shadows. And I'm just like, but you're just doing it wrong. Right.
So it's if just I lack had, of skill.
Yes, but that's the look. I mean, I've had two jobs in the past where
it's looking like you're not trying. Right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, exactly. It's bedhead. It's the bedhead of photography. I've had two jobs in the past where I was told the final images were too professional. And I'm just like, what is happening?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So, yeah, as it moves on, people kind of have a amnesia, yeah, about what they were previously rejecting.
They do, for sure. And nostalgia. The
yes.
past was better. The past I didn't experience was better.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I think it also says a lot about how the tools that we're developing are too perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everything's
oh,
getting
yeah.
repaired. So it's like we're hungry for the mistakes.
Yes.
And we're hungry for these things that look like something that has to do with,
yes,
like the human hand screwing
yeah.
it up, right? Like something that looks singular, not so cookie cutter.
Yeah, and also a weird authenticity. I guess it's not weird, but it. I was discussing with somebody once that I thought that film, in a certain aspect, film was easier because there were parameters. But this
like film
people,
stock,
like
yeah,
actual
analog,
film,
yep.
Because if there's a light leak, it's just there. And you can accept it. You're like, oh, that happened. That's still a cool picture. But this person was much younger than me and didn't grow up with film.
Mm.
So they were like, oh, film is so much harder, you know, because there's all of these other aspects. And you can just put a filter.
Mm.
But for me, it's like, well, where does the filter go? You can put the light leak anywhere you want. Where do I put it? You know, there are no parameters.
Right.
Whereas if you're shooting with film and you make a mistake, you're like, but that's still cool. And you can accept it. And it's in your head authentic. And it happened, and that's fine.
Right, right.
But yeah, with digital and Photoshop and AI and all of these things, I mean, it's like there are no limits to what you can make up.
Right.
So for somebody like myself, I'm like, you know, that's a panic moment.
Sure, yeah. Just like what you were trained on, right?
Yeah,
really,
yeah.
Really orients the way that you see this.
Yep. So anyway, so we get to this. In the beginning of your book, you discussed something that is near and dear to my heart, and that is photos becoming almost a starting point now. You notice this in, mm-hmm. with your students, for other things, as a jumping mm-hmm. off point.
Right.
So the photo not remaining just, quote unquote, just a photo.
Right.
So now it becomes a place, you know, a springboard mm-hmm. to get to somewhere else.
Right.
So talk about that a little bit, something that you've discussed, or like you said, you noticed with your students.
Yeah, I noticed. So I work with a lot of photography students. I teach in two graduate photo programs. So these are students that presumably are studying to be photographers. And I say presumably because, you know, you look at their work and it's not obvious that they're even working with images or even a camera or anything like this. And so what I started to notice in the last few years is, I don't know if there's a turn away from the photo image per se, not as a starting point, but as an end point.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that really interesting. The digital allows us to continue to manipulate, right? It almost feels like this could never end.
Mm-hmm.
You can change something endlessly. You can come back to it and it can take on a totally different form. It can become something else entirely. Part of that has to do with the different ways we can print, not just printing on paper even, but like 3D printing and other forms of manipulation that just allow for so many different possibilities. So the malleability of the digital has really, I think, changed the way a lot of students, in my experience, are working. And so I started to notice this, that they might start off with kind of photographs proper, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something that looks like a photograph or, you know, they took with their phone or with a digital camera. Very few of them are working in analog, but there are some. But then they're interested in doing something else with it.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to transform it into something else. They want to layer it. They want to use different digital processes. They want to print it, re-photograph, reprint it, you know, choose different substrates even. So printing it on fabric, printing it on different materials.
So that's my entire
so
practice
much,
is,
exactly,
is that.
So much manipulation mm-hmm. and so much I guess, almost like, you know, combining different sensibilities, sculpture even, right? Installation, just lots of different things coming together through the image.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to really think about the photograph as the starting point for so many things. And as a media theorist, I know this from a technical standpoint, like photography really is the beginning of computing. It's the beginning of so many things. And that's maybe a whole other program, but and maybe a different book, really. Mm-hmm. But I talk about it a little bit in this book. But there really is this. It's kind of the starting point for the modern world that we have now. The visual culture that we live in is all reliant on this kind of logic of photography.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it just becomes the center point of so many things.
Yeah.
And different practices, different ways of conceiving of art.
Yeah, and again, where does photography, where does it fit in? What are the parameters around photography? What kind of constitutes a photograph? Like mm-hmm. you said, if photos are everywhere, but nowhere at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So what else should we discuss?
Should we dive in?
Yeah.
Well, so maybe it's worth saying, like I use this term post-photography, but it's mm-hmm. not really a common term. I don't know many people who use it.
No, I hadn't.
I feel like I've latched onto it. It was introduced in the 90s to really kind of account for this crisis of photography with the onset of digital cameras and digital processing and things like this. And of course, the advent of the internet kind of created this new way of working with images. Suddenly, it's like we have these troves of images online that we can share, mm-hmm. Flickr and things like this. And so manipulation and just appropriation of other people's images became like a new possibility in a different way. It mm-hmm. had existed before that. And so this term, sort of was pointing to something new, right? This newness of photography. And this is something that you and I just discussed before we went live. I feel like that digital crisis or whatever the crisis of photography was kind of like settled in. We absorbed the shock
mm-hmm.
and then we just started to accept that these are also photographs. They're just photographs. They're digital. We're simulating light, but who cares? It's fine. They still look like photographs, right? I still point a camera at an object. I'm still looking at something. I still have to take it out in the world with me. And so all of those things about photography were maintained. It wasn't such a huge leap.
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, I mean, you still, yes, for some people it was.
There were still purists.
Yes. But you still were holding a camera.
You're still holding a camera.
I mean, that's the thing that it when I was in college in 2000, it was on the horizon. Mm-hmm. But like we were discussing, I think there was one digital camera in the lockup, which is, for anybody that doesn't know, that's in the college. That's where you check out, borrow equipment from.
Yeah.
And nobody would dare touch it. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to take the digital camera out. And so a lot of the 4 years that I was in college, that was what all the discussions ended up being, was what is photography? And I felt like, at least in my school and my city, I was in Boston, I feel like there was this conceptual overcorrection
mm-hmm.
where all of a sudden it became... there was kind of two modes of overcorrection, which seemed disparate, but they really weren't. It was either very strictly purist photography, documentary, 11x14 prints, or it was very conceptual, where somebody would, take a photo of a white wall, and we would have to discuss it for an hour and a half. So yes, even though those things seem very disparate, they're not. In the world of photography, they're not. They were accepted, very traditional
by that time,
So photography is photography, and it is silver, and it is paper.
And it is analog.
Yeah. Yes, everything was very pure. And at the time, I had come from a craft background. Mm-hmm. I grew up in an area that art was not, capital A art, was mm-hmm. not a thing. It was not a part of daily life, but everybody made stuff.
Right.
So that was the background that I came from. So of course, using my hands, being very physical with my work was part of it. So I would be embroidering on my pictures, ripping them up, stapling them back together, mm-hmm. This whole thing. And it was not accepted
because
that was not photography. And at the time, I kind of saw it as, because this this terrifying thing called digital photography was on the horizon and everybody saw it and mm-hmm. knew it was coming. That's why everybody became very rigid in their,
yeah.
in their, you know, definition of what photography is. And then, like you said, it came anyway.
Yeah.
It came just the same.
Sure. AI today, right?
Yeah. So at a certain point, everybody had to accept that, that digital was a tool like right. anything else, like the Polaroid, you know, like, yeah. like anything else, digital was here and it was here to stay and it was a little bit easier, a little bit cheaper. I mean, I took a commercial photography class and now, you know, with the Polaroid, with the Chromes, mm-hmm. with the whole thing. And now I can't imagine, I can't imagine shooting a wedding
right.
on film right. and just being
what
like,
a hassle.
Cross your fingers.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope I got it. But yeah, at the time that seemed like a horrifying thing to do. And now it's just so commonplace. But I feel like that seemed to be the mountain that we got up. And now what you're talking about, the post-photography era seems to be kind of what came after that.
Sure.
Which is very interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, it just continued to kind of snowball, mm-hmm. you know, all of this new technology, just, you know, this one new technology came and it was terrifying and it was going to change everything. And then everything else that came after that seemed to just come faster and faster and faster and faster.
Right, right. Yeah, that's interesting. As far as mountains are concerned, because these are 20th century mountains, right? That mm-hmm. first one was a 20th century mountain. But you know, there are other littler mountains, maybe, and significant ones even that we didn't experience directly mm-hmm. That preceded all this. And
yeah.
so I think that's interesting too. And I think even the question. Many people have written books. What is photography, right? On photography, you know, so many things. Like mm-hmm. we can't really define it. And so when we insist that this is photography and this isn't photography and yet can't settle on a definition of mm-hmm. photography, like I think that says a lot about how big it is
mm-hmm.
and how like plural it is. And inevitably we're not going to come to one conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, interestingly, post-photography makes sort of a claim that this is something different,
mm-hmm.
right? But is just as big, I would say, as photography itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest distinguishing factor is maybe, just as one layer, the difference between digital and analog. Because there's so many different ways to make analog images,
mm-hmm.
right? Like there isn't one definition for an analog image.
No.
And how differently your apparatus, your film stock, like so many different conditions can shape the image itself.
Yes.
Including cameraless photography, mm-hmm. which I do talk about because we're back. We're back to cameraless photography. And we're back to, you know, sort of rethinking not only whether we even need a camera to make an image, but whether we need subjects to make an image,
mm-hmm.
whether we need a photographer to make an image. Like, all of these things are being kind of reconsidered. But to get back to your point about craft and how this kind of layered process around photography also troubles the waters for so many people, you know, like, what is that about, right? So one of the things I'm interested in with this book is really thinking about, so when I talked about this kind of crisis of art and a crisis of truth. This is where the truth part comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's something interesting about trying to link photography to the physical world. And the things that you're describing and the things that I witness my students doing feels like a direct connection to the physical world. It's
mm-hmm.
an index, if you will. It's a way of connecting to the human actor who's doing it, right? The person who's making the work.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless of what digital tools you're using or if you're handling a camera at all, there is this sense of like the human hand
mm-hmm.
for
yes.
sure,
yeah.
right? The stapling, the tearing, mm-hmm. the whatever. And I think that's an interesting aspect that tends to get overlooked, let's say, when we're kind of evaluating these types of artworks because we don't know where to place them. They're not easy to categorize.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too, because I feel like because people obviously would say, well, why photography? So,
right.
you know, if you're,
why start there?
Yeah, why is there a photo included
yeah.
if you're then taking it and doing something else?
Right.
And for me, it used to be because that connects it to the real world.
Yes.
It's the truth.
Yes.
And now it's like, so if you're looking at a quilt that I made out of cardboard, but
mm-hmm.
it has a photograph
mm-hmm.
of a person printed on it, to me, that was, you're showing that that is the truth, that's a real person, you're connecting it to the real world and real problems and whatever. So now, with that symbolism, with the onslaught of AI, it starts to be, you know, I'll go to a show and people will ask me, did you take that photo? And so it's an interesting thing that you're like, well, yeah, of course I did.
Of course I did, yeah.
But yeah, it's this whole new thing where it's like, well, now does the image not symbolize reality?
Right.
Because now you don't have to take that photo.
Right.
You know, somebody could...
You didn't have to have taken it, right, yourself. Yeah, these are interesting questions. And I think the explosion of AI, and we're talking about generative AI specifically. Mm-hmm, yeah. AI has been around for a while, but generative AI
tools... Or just
AI
the
tools,
internet of Googling a picture and taking
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. I was going to say, like, this does resemble some of the easy ways that we can appropriate images. No, I borrowed that from someone else. Mm-hmm. Or no, I found this, whatever. I Googled it. I acquired it somehow. Mm-hmm. Or it's from a magazine, whatever. Like, we've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
And so, but I think the explosion of it, as I said... how commonplace it's become is now on everybody's radar. So that's like sort of the response, right? Is this this? Is this not the truth? Is this something you didn't do? What shortcuts did you take, right? So all of this is on everyone's mind right now, including like, did you write this, right? is any of this real? You know, are these our real voices, right? Like so many things, like so many ways that we can, you know, hack the truth and kind of create things out of nothing. But I also contend that it's not out of nothing, that there is a root, there is a, like source material. And as kind of circuitous as it is, I think it's still really valuable for now. This is the setup we have for now, that you still can trace it back to something in the physical world, something that we experienced, if only through those processes, like I said, right? The time it took you to source the image, even if you didn't take it, and even kind of parsing through other images and kind of doing the work of using tools, using digital tools even, all of which replicate in some way or another the things that we do in the physical world, cutting things, right? So I think that's an interesting kind of aspect of the digital world we live in. So many of those things now aren't tangible things.
Which is interesting as well. I mean, not to go on a completely different pathway, but just thinking about even family photos, things like that, they don't exist as, you know, I mean, everybody's parents, I
really
feel like, has
them.
Has a box, a Tupperware full of photos or a drawer full of photos. They don't get printed.
Right.
Which is interesting to me. I print photos, so I have those of my own children, but something like video, you know, like where is that?
Right.
Where is that video I took 10 years ago?
Can we even access it?
Yeah.
Anymore?
I don't know where it is.
Where would I play it now?
I find myself very rarely taking video of my children because to me it's like, well, where does it go?
Right.
You know, if I take a photo, I know I'll print the photo book because I do that. But yeah, it's like you take a video and you're like, well, that's just in the ethos. Where did that go?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It kind of disappears at that point. Yeah.
But again, that's a tangible, maybe it's just because I'm older, but yeah, you feel like if something, I can't hold something in my hands, it's not real.
Right.
So yeah, that's.
Well, I think you're
I'm
touching
just blowing
on a really
my own
interesting,
mind
no,
over.
For sure. If you can't hold it, it doesn't exist. No, it's an interesting thing because I think it changes how we think about photographic images. Photographic images, like living a whole life of taking photographs that you'll never print. I mean, that's many people's experiences. Mm-hmm. And so what happens
and
to
taking
those things?
And taking 10,000 of them.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I mean, when you had film, you're like, I got 10 pictures.
There's only so many of these.
Yeah, exactly.
These are expensive.
So like, I'm just taking the one.
Right.
But I even noticed myself doing it. And again, the vast majority of my life, I used film. But even now, you're just like, sometimes you're not even paying attention in a shoe, and you're just basically holding that button down. You're like, whoa, 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 what am I doing?
I'm not being very discerning.
Yeah,
at all.
I need to wait for the moment instead of just bang, 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 bang.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it definitely changes the way we make things.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
But I almost see this as like, this is why we're trying to do different things, I guess, with photographic images and why they don't end up looking like photographs anymore often. Just like the hunger for something different in a world filled with images, you know, we're just inundated with so much visual information.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, we think, I mean, I do. I think most people do think in images, think photographically.
Yeah.
So I feel like no one will ever turn away from it.
Right.
It's just a matter of exploring what does it mean now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's definitely undergoing a transformation.
Yeah.
And I think, I hope we're taking time to think about it more.
Yeah.
Right? And not just like, in a way I see it as like, maybe this is what happened with language as writing and literacy took off more and more and was more widespread. I wonder if there was a similar thing happening, like, oh, this whole time we've been speaking, we've been talking to one another, singing songs, you know, citing poetry, whatever. But once you can write things down, it sort of changes everything. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost the reverse, because here we're going from like the printed thing to the now like digital thing that doesn't really exist in the world. But yeah. I do think like images, we tend to think, don't have a locked in meaning. They're just open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's so many images, I almost feel like, no, I think actually we've come to a point where we need to reconsider that.
Yeah.
Right? We need to reconsider the whole thing and really teach visual literacy and really mm-hmm. understand how things are made and what they mean when we make them mean things, right? Certain yeah. things. So it's interesting to me that this could be an opportunity to just reflect on that differently.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I feel like definitely, yeah, there should be more discussion about that, especially with kids that are growing up in this environment. I feel like I have a skepticism when I see images, especially, you know, on social media and things like that, that I feel like children might not have.
Mm.
Or maybe they'll have it. Maybe they'll have an overcorrection and not believe anything. I don't know.
Yeah, what's happening.
Yeah, my kids are younger, so they don't have social media or anything yet. But yeah, it's like I'm constantly telling my daughter's 12, mm. so she doesn't have social media, but she's on the cusp of all of those yeah. things. And so yeah, I'm constantly, you know, telling her that she needs to be skeptical,
mm-hmm.
you know, of everything that she sees, which is also unfortunate. But again, it's this wave is coming no matter what we do.
Right.
So there has to be discussion about that.
Well, one of the points I make, and I don't get too far into like documentary photography, mm-hmm. because I do feel like, you know, I focus on artists and they have so much license, right? Creative yeah. license to just do whatever. And, mm-hmm. you know, you can play with this idea of fabrication and invention, and that's fine. That's what we expect. And so it's difficult to have this conversation and then just ignore the reality of like what a photograph means. Mm-hmm. Is it telling the truth about an event happening in the world yeah. sort of thing? But I do feel like this is the moment where we can even reflect on maybe our bad habits all along, accepting every photograph for what we think it says. Right?
Oh, 100%.
Like, and not even evaluating like maybe what it's leaving out or what it's, you know, trying to reinforce. Right.
Yes.
And so those relationships, I think, to images have not been established at all for decades, right? We've just been living with photography and accepting that they are true enough and not really questioning, you know, the motivations of the photographer or, you know, the ideologies maybe that they reinforce, whatever. So I think those are interesting, again, opportunities to maybe go back and really reconsider.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely something that I had never considered, again, until I was in school for photography.
Right.
And it was definitely kind of a duh moment, but you just don't think about those
yeah.
things. And taking, you know, some sort of, you know, history of photo class or whatever, and you realize that, you know, this or that famous photo,
yeah,
you know, it all depends on, you know, even though it was quote unquote what happened mm-hmm. and they just took a picture of it, what did the photographer choose to include or
yeah.
not include
yeah.
or, you know, so you start to realize that even though this is accepted as an objective medium
yeah.
that is just capturing what's in front of the person, it's not. There's no, there's
absolutely.
No way for a human to be fully objective.
Exactly.
And so they're still making decisions. And yeah, so this has been going on for forever.
For forever.
Did that person happen to be standing there? Yes.
Right.
But you don't know the 5 minutes before, the 5 minutes after,
yeah.
what was on the left, what was on the right.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's always been an issue.
Yeah. And I also think there's something interesting, especially with the internet, but even before this with mass media, you know, these images that you're, you know, I can picture a few that you're probably referring to as well, right? Like, oh yeah, these like famous images from the past and whatever. Yeah, they're true to a point, but they also become icons, right?
Yes.
And so the power of iconography mm-hmm. kind of blinds us to all I don't know, speculation even. Like, mm-hmm. we're not questioning them because we forgive them for being part of the past. And again, nostalgia plays into it and all these other things. And so
we're just, photography not is so even emotional. Bothering.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, oh, it's been too long. Who cares?
Yeah.
Right. The damage is done or whatever.
Yeah.
but yeah, no, it's so interesting that we sort of accept those things. And only now do we feel panicked because I think because of AI.
Yes.
But I think we should have been panicked all along. And again,
and
not panicked, but like just, again, discerning and really just kind of like understanding these are interpretations of reality, mm-hmm. right? These are constructions of reality. They're meaning making, right?
And being aware of how prevalent AI has already been in our lives.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the other thing is that people, even myself.
In our cameras, are you kidding?
Oh, my, yeah. I mean, it's been everywhere.
Yeah.
For quite some time, it's just now for some reason that people are starting to panic about it. And again, we should. I mean, it's opening up this can of worms that we're not even really sure where it begins and where it ends and whatever. But yeah, people have had it in their daily lives for quite a while.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Especially in their smartphones, if you just want to talk about photography,
we could just talk about smartphones. Yes. We could talk about computational photography, and that's a whole book. That's a whole
Oh gosh, how many times I've tried to explain digital photography to people?
Well, I could
just do that with my phone. It's like, okay, then just do it. I can't talk to you about this. It's correcting it for you.
Oh, it's anticipating everything you want. It is learning from your other images.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another aspect I think that's really fundamental to all of this is like the smartness, mm-hmm. let's say. I mean, for lack of a better term, like we're making images and we're making systems that create images that are smart, that mm-hmm. know things about you and that contain a ton of information above and beyond what you see in the mm-hmm. picture. And that's really interesting, too.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the visual literacy, let's say, that, I mean, most people don't understand that. Why would you? You don't need to know it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's kind of the brownie camera effect. It's better not to know, actually.
Yeah.
It's inefficient. I don't need to know that to make a picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, those are the things that I think are really, kind of fascinating about photography, but also where post-photography is taking
mm-hmm.
it.
I also think it's interesting, too, again, I guess not necessarily off topic, it's just about photo, but when it comes to family photos,
mm-hmm.
there are no, maybe not no, but there are very few mistakes in a family photo now. You know, like the goofy photo or somebody's eyes are closed.
Oh, yeah.
Or, you know, that kind of snapshot aspect.
Yeah.
That aesthetic is gone.
Yeah.
You know, I fall prey to it as well. But yeah, everybody in every photo is sitting and smiling and you can take 400 of them and everybody's eyes are open.
Right.
And
one of them is going to work out.
Yes. Yes.
Your camera doesn't correct for you, right?
Yes. And you just keep pressing that button.
I remember the red eye correction.
Yes.
And, you know, slowly we started getting more and more things mm-hmm. in digital cameras.
Yep.
And even the one that like wouldn't take a photo until you smile, like everyone has to be smiling
yes.
in this. Which is so interesting because it's like, this is not truth. What?
No.
Like that we're all just smiling the
yep.
same. And like, yeah, it's an interesting way of thinking about how photography has also shaped our expectations of what reality should look like.
Mm-hmm.
How I want to remember that day.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And again, and everybody's static.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that I think is interesting. Yeah. There's no more, you know, here were the kids hunting for eggs on Easter or whatever.
Right.
No,
there's always one that's
kids,
blurred, right?
Like, yes.
The one who keeps getting away.
Somebody's in the background or whatever.
Right.
I kind of miss those.
The spontaneity of it.
Yeah. And again, because you didn't know until a week or 2 years.
Or two, yeah.
Or whenever it was you got that film developed. And you're like, what? Everybody's heads are cropped off. That's the spontaneity of photography. I feel like I had more to say about family photos just because I had something but now I can't remember what I was thinking. So, we have 12 minutes left.
Oh, okay. That gives us time to dig into some things.
Yeah.
One of the things I want to know, I guess, from you mm-hmm. is as a photographer who's working in this way that goes above and beyond the image, let's mm-hmm. say, to the point where maybe even somebody might say, and has asked you, why do you include an image to begin with if this doesn't look like a photographic image in the end? What is that all about? But one of the questions I have for you is sort of about this idea of truth and authenticity. These are two terms that kind of bother me because they're, you know, problematic in themselves. How do we define them? But I think we use them all the time to refer to things having to do with photography. Did that happen? Didn't it happen? Did it accurately represent what happened, etc.? So I just wonder how that plays into your work.
I would say that there's always a conceptual aspect to my work. So I'm telling usually a larger story. So my work deals with mothers. I photograph mothers. And it's about, the general gist is that, so I photograph all of these moms. They're not models. I just find them. People, you know, will recommend people to me. It's word of mouth, whatever. So they're just moms. They come in with their kids. I photograph them on a white background so that I can easily cut them out and then do other things with the images. And then I like to tell a story. I print all of the images on experimental substrate. So I'm just using my Epson printer and figuring out how to manipulate the printer to print on different things, plastic bags, cardboard, tin soda cans. And the concept is that I don't feel that mothers have the proper tools to do their jobs. So therefore, I'm literally doing my job as a photographer without the proper tools, i.e. paper. So it takes 10 times longer than it should, because if I had a piece of paper, I would just put it in and print. And then once it's printed on these various substrates, then I try to stitch them or staple them or whatever to put them back together to create this beautiful image. So the image is important,
right?
Because I'm trying to create this perfect image from the garbage I've been given. So it's a very literal concept.
Right.
It's very, you know, it's, I'm very process oriented. Yeah. Like I said, everything is very physical to me. It's, you know, my medicine. I have to do these things to kind of ground myself. So when it comes to truth and authenticity, it's important to me that the images are real mothers. They're not, like I said, they're not models, they're real people.
Right.
And they were really in my studio and I really talked to them and I really heard their stories. So I guess it's very personal to me. It's a personal parameter that the truth and authenticity is there,
right?
Because it's an experience for me as well as for them.
Yeah.
And then the thing that I make from it is very secondary, but that's always been, I've been yelled at before for that being the case, in college. But so the experience itself, the truth and authenticity in the experience is what's important to me.
Yeah.
And then the after effects, whatever I end up with at the end of the day, I guess is less important, you know, what people take from it. And people have had wildly different reactions to my work. Some people are offended by it, that these images are printed on garbage or whatever. For me, the entire thing is just in the action of photographing the moms,
right?
And then processing their stories and my story. So that's it. For me, it's just the process and the experience of it, which I wouldn't get if I was sourcing the material from elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. And it becomes like a new way of making portraits, right?
Yes.
Because portraits are really an interpretation. It's a way of communicating something about your subjects, right? Often it's like,
and for me, the reason I picked photography was because I love people. I just love meeting new people and listening to what they have to say. And that's why I'm on the radio, you know, meeting different people, meeting yourself. I just love to meet people, and photography has always been a great way of doing that. And because it's a photograph, it seems to capture a moment in time, and it's still a document to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though it's not quote unquote traditional documentary, to me it is, because you're documenting people in a place and a time. And capturing that moment.
Right.
So to me, like I said, photography and the act of photographing is about a connection with people. And having the camera between myself and the subject seems less a distraction, less invasive, maybe, than if I was painting them or something like that. It seems like, yes, we're here to do a job. Mm-hmm. I'm here to photograph you. But it seems like it's not as much of a barrier to me finding out who that person is.
Right, right.
And I love photographing kids. People think it's horrible, but I think it's fantastic because the kids don't care. They don't care what, there's no self-consciousness there at all. They're just being their complete authentic selves. And usually the mothers are so wrapped up in getting that child to behave quote unquote properly that they lose themselves and they become their authentic self in a weird way because they're focused on something else, the child, and they drop their guard and are no longer concerned with how they look. And so everybody, even though sometimes there's stress and they're freaking out because the kid is crying and this and that and the other, still you're getting this authentic moment.
Right.
And for me, when I had children, I didn't have anyone around me who had kids. And so for a long time, you know, a lot of these thoughts and feelings that I had about motherhood, I thought were just me.
Right.
And so once I started doing this work and I started meeting other mothers, it became, you know, not a connected community per se, but you started to get a glimpse that, oh my gosh, we're all doing this. We're all marching in the same direction, just maybe from different points of view.
Right.
So, yeah. So for me, like I said, again, to reiterate, photography is it's an experience for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. I think it speaks to the social nature of photography in general. I think all photography is social.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the reason I picked up a camera to begin with when I was 15 was just to document what was going on. I was having a hard time with, I had a really good friend move, and I was having a hard time with that because I'd never experienced that before. And I started taking pictures because it felt like a way of capturing or controlling or, you know, and documenting what was going on. You know, if I can take a picture of this, it was about memory, which I think people still have a connection to photography as memory keepers.
Yeah, definitely. It's a memory medium through and through.
Yeah.
I think even through its transformations, it maintains that.
Yeah. But people need to print more photos. Make that photo book.
Yeah.
Print the pictures.
Let's figure
kids.
Out what to do with our videos.
Yeah.
Right.
We need it. Yeah. We
can't let them go
into
like wherever this pit
Where
of,
do they go?
Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. We need to bring that.
We definitely do.
Somehow.
Yeah. There needs to be some tangible place where we put video. Cause I don't understand. I don't understand where they are. And stop putting filters on everything too. Cause they'll not be cool at a certain point.
I wonder if they'll even be readable in some contexts.
Yeah.
Like how will they interfere with the future?
How they interfere. People would be like, wow, everything was really brown in the early 2000s. Like that sepia tone in early Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah, just
I guess we've been through that before too, right?
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Those weird effects.
All right, we have 3 minutes left, but I wanted to reiterate that you are Natasha Chuk.
Yeah.
And you wrote a book.
Yes.
A fascinating book called Photo Obscura. And if people want to find out more information or get the book, where will they find you?
I have a website where all my information lives. It's my name, natashachuk.com. Last name is C-H-U-K. Yes. But yeah, the book was published by Intellect Press, and the distributor is the University of Chicago Press. So it's pretty widely available wherever they, you know, sell books.
Another tangible thing.
I would rather not name like the big, you know, distributor that we're all trying to avoid.
Yeah.
But, you know, people know where to go if they look it up. So, yeah.
And books are great. Hold it in your
books
hand.
Books are great. They really are. I was really happy to write this book. I was thinking about it, have been thinking about it because it just came out. It's been on my mind, obviously, for the last few years, but it really feels like kind of a living document. I know writing is not supposed to be that. It's supposed to be definitive, but it feels like I want it to be part of like the start of something bigger and just like having conversations like this. So, yeah, that's sort of the intent with it.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. And like I said, if you care about, even if you're not a photographer, if you're into art or anything like that, it really is a fantastic book, and it can be applied to so many things in our kind of digital AI landscape.
Yeah, and the visual world at large, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Which we're all a part of, whether you consider yourself an artist or not. You know, you can't say that visuals and images aren't part of your daily life.
Right.
Yeah.
We care about them,
we
for
care,
sure.
Yeah.
And we experience the world through them.
Yeah, for yeah. sure, for sure. I feel like especially nowadays, I mean, people go outside less and less and less, and you're seeing the outside world through images.
Yeah.
So understand your relation to images.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Natasha, thank you so much for coming, and thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I will be back in January. I don't even know when that is. It seems so far away, and tomorrow at the same time. Oh, it looks like January 2nd. I'll be back in my normal time slot from 5 to 6. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next time, thank you, Natasha,
Thanks
for joining
so much.
Us.